welcome to the Sustainable Nano Podcast. I'm your host, Miriam Kraus. We took a little break there for a while. As you may remember, we are a production of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which is funded by the National Science Foundation. And here's a little behind-the-scenes info in case you're curious. Every 2 years, a big research center like ours has to go through a very intensive review process by the National Science Foundation, make sure we're doing what we said we're going to do and producing good science. And so that's what we've been occupied with for about the last month, but we're very happy to have completed that review, and we're happy to be back here presenting you with some new podcast episodes. We'll have a few more episodes this late spring, early summer, before we go on a slightly longer hiatus for the summer break into fall. Now, for this episode, we're very pleased to bring you an interview with two scientists from the Center for Nanotechnology and Society at Arizona State University, Ira Bennett and Jamie Wetmore. They recently visited the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota Nano Center, where they presented a seminar on societal and ethical implications of nanotechnology. So this seemed like it was right up the alley for our Sustainable Nano podcast. So I had a chance to sit down with them for a little while and talk about these issues. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Ira and Jamie. Thank you very much for coming, being on the Sustainable Nano podcast with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah. Do you want to introduce yourselves very briefly? Just tell us who you are and what you do.
So I'm Jamie Wetmore. I'm an associate professor at the School for the Future of Innovation and Society at Arizona State University. But I also head up the Societal and Ethical Implications Program for the National Nanotechnology Coordinated Infrastructure. I think I got that all right.
That's a lot of words.
It is.
So here's my lots of words. I'm Ira Bennett. I'm a clinical associate professor at the School for the Future of Innovation and Society at Arizona State University. And I also co-direct with Jamie here the Center for Engagement and Training in Science and Society, which is a research center that does a lot of very public-facing science meets policy meets society programming. And Jamie's nano program is one of our large ones, but also working with science museums is another large component of that.
We have gotten to the point in our society where if your business card only has one word under your name, you're really important. The more words it has, the less important you are.
No, that's right. And of course, at ASU, I believe, if you add them up, I have 9 different titles. They don't give you raises. They just give you more titles.
More titles.
So why is it important that people who are studying nanotechnology, for example, as researchers, why do you want them to care about what you study as far as social and ethical implications of what they're doing? If they're like, well, I'm a bench scientist, I want to know, you know.
Yeah, so a lot of people, when they hear the word ethics, they're like, okay, I don't lie, I don't cheat, I don't steal, I must be ethical, I'm moving on with my life. And that's good. I'm very glad that people take that approach, but I think there's an additional layer is, you know, so as scientists and engineers, you know, we've been given a huge amount of power, hold great prestige in our society, get decent paychecks, you know, not terrible, certainly better than our colleagues in the humanities, which we don't need to go into that. And the work that we do can have such a profound impact on the world. And we're excited about that. I mean, we're really glad that we make a difference. But we don't always know how those connections work. We don't always know how what we do in a lab actually has an impact on people outside the lab. And I think the more people in labs recognize and understand the way that their research has an impact on the world, the more likely they're to guide it towards the positive futures that they're really excited about. The reason they got to become a scientist to begin with.
I sort of have 2 things to add to that. One is that we often create things and think about what we've created later, as sort of Jamie pointed out. And the example I'd like to use on that is how much current science being funded is to undo the effects of the previous generation of science, right? So we've invented entire agencies to just manage the environmental impacts of previous generations of science. And so that's one approach to solving the problem, but Jamie and I think that if we create an awareness that what scientists are creating now have impact later on and get them aware of that, that maybe they'll make slightly different decisions. And this, I think, falls in line with sustainable nanotechnology very much.
Sustainability in a nutshell, you could say.
But I think we see it the physical instantiation of that in funding entire agencies like the EPA to undo what we've done with previous science thing. The other thing is it's not an accident that scientists don't think about, especially, you know, graduate students, don't think about this stuff. We have created a structure in which we educate scientists and to some extent engineers, but certainly scientists, yeah. that separates the act of doing science from the concept that it has impacts later on. And in fact, you can do, you know, when I did my PhD, I took 4 classes, all of which were about the subject which I would do my dissertation work on, and then I spent the rest of the time in the dissertation. There was nothing about what it meant to build things, right? And in fact, I spent a lot of time sitting in the dark by myself because I did photochemistry stuff. You know, what if I invented something, a molecule, for instance, which is what I did, and published it in some journal, and somebody read that and turned it into something that I hated or that was bad or put people out of work or was toxic or whatever? What responsibility do I have as the person that initially invented that molecule?
Is there an answer?
Immense responsibility and no responsibility at the same time, right? So I mean, that's sort of a stark contrast, but I think getting people recognizing that what you do has an impact while you're doing it maybe can help alleviate some of this.
Yeah, and one of the things we always try to make clear is that we're not helping people predict the future. We can't know exactly what's going to happen from any lab, what might ultimately result. But you can be thinking about that future as you do it. And that has a significant impact on increasing the chances that it will produce the future that you would actually want. And so helping people to think about their research as they do it. And in addition, helping people find the people to talk to get the bigger picture. The goal is not to train every scientist and engineer in how to understand their relationship with society. But if you can build up the confidence in people that, you know what, I wonder what effect this could have on the economy. Maybe I should actually have a chat with an economist for an hour or two. Just those discussions can have a profound impact on the direction of the research.
And in the dawn of nanotechnology in the early 2000s, you had a bunch of scientists and engineers saying things like, the next industrial revolution. And if you think back to the last industrial revolution, it had some profound social, environmental, economic impacts. Maybe we should think about, if you're just going to throw out industrial revolutions willy-nilly, like I get to think about this too.
Yeah, but they were thinking specifically about the, wow, we went from, horse and buggy, steam-powered stuff,
right.
to... Yay, automobiles and
right.
automated manufacturing or whatever. But
to the creation of the EPA to try to fix all those problems.
Exactly. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit, since we are Sustainable Nano, can you talk a little bit specifically about, you mentioned nanotechnology, like what are some current things that you see in like the state of the science and the state of the social implications of the science and how those things fit together?
What is it, 12 years ago now? Something like that. The National Science Foundation launched 2 centers for nanotechnology in society. And Ira and I were both part of the CNS at Arizona State University. And a big part of the goal of that center was to find ways to work hand in hand with scientists and engineers, to sort of integrate the discussion and the research on the social and ethical aspects, with the practicing scientists and engineers. So partially we're a little disappointed, of course, that that funding's over, that 11 years, and it was a really good ride and accomplished huge amounts of things. We're very, very pleased with it. As a result, sort of the discussion of nano in society has dipped a little bit. There isn't an active large center really focusing on it. That being said, the fact that the University of Minnesota invited us out here to do this talk is that it's been sort of built into some of the infrastructure. It's been built into the way that people think. When you talk to your normal nanoscientists and you throw out the word social, they don't immediately say, that doesn't have anything to do with us. Mm-hmm. There is a recognition that there is importance. It may not be, complete understanding of exactly how they should fit together, but there is now a culture where these two things are talked about hand in hand.
And I would say from the state of the science, over the last decade, you've seen a tempering of the wild claims mm-hmm. that were being made in the early 2000s, both on the incredible wonder and the existential crisis part, right? So
can you talk a little bit about that for people who don't remember or weren't...
Sure. Well, I mean, it
back
goes...
Back in the day.
Right. So back in the day, it was the next Industrial Revolution, or it was the planet covered in a collection of silicon-based gray goo, which self-replicating nanobots had consumed everything.
Wiped out life
in general, right? Not even as we know it. Like, it was just it was just not life anymore.
Only the nanobots.
Right? Only the nanobots, right? So, and I think, you know, some of my work on nanoparticles with another project has shown that, you know, nanoparticles initially were a big toxic concern. They could move through blood-brain barrier. They
get in the wastewater stream.
Right. They get in, you know, there's this whole fate in transport. How do they move? Where do they go? We found them to be pretty benign and not as common as we were saying in the wild, heady days of 2004, right? So I think from the state of science, the science has matured to a point where we're not seeing some of the more radical nanobot stuff that was, you know, which was at the edge of science and science fiction. And that's not to say that it won't come, but I think it sort of has become an industrial process. And so from some of the more radical concerns that got social scientists excited about studying this, you know, the future of humanity and these sort of things, you know, those discussions aren't as relevant now as we see sort of the trajectory that nanotechnology has taken.
Mm-hmm. But also, there hasn't been the nano disaster that people
were
afraid
of. Right.
And the other thing that hasn't happened is there hasn't been the massive public backlash against nano either. Mm-hmm. Probably those two are interrelated. And as a result, about 10, 15 years ago, companies were doing nanotechnology and removing the name from their products. And they haven't...
The word, right.
The word, yeah, just the word. For fear of it having a negative association amongst the public. And I think we're almost at this point. We're like, yeah, nano, okay, whatever.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it is a tempering of both hopes and fears.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Yeah.
One of our students wrote a blog post, actually, about this exact question of why our companies sometimes are concerned about labeling, and there's this chemophobia that sometimes scientists are perhaps overly concerned that the public will be afraid of science, of chemistry, of nano, whatever. But I was wondering, would you, in that framework, tell the story of the Benny the Bear that you were telling us in the workshop earlier? Because I think that's a really interesting example of that, right?
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to know if Benny the Bear could be made today. But anyways, the story of Benny the Bear, and I'm trying to think what year this was. 2005, 2006?
That seems about right.
Somewhere in there. 2007. Benny the Bear was created, and Benny is the first that I know of, and perhaps the only nano-enhanced teddy bear. And so Benny the Bear is impregnated with nano silver particles, and those silver particles, of course, prevent bacteria from growing and prevent mold from growing, and a lot of the things that young kids with asthma or severe allergies would be, you know, highly reactive to. And so as a result, Benny the Bear was embraced, won a couple of awards from like parents' organizations and things like that for finally creating a teddy bear that certain kids could have that they previously couldn't have teddy bears. But the question came out, what do small children do with teddy bears? And of course, they hug them and squeeze them and put them in their mouth. And so if you put a teddy bear impregnated with nanosilver in your mouth, you're going to ingest some of that nanosilver. And so the question came out through actually just a simple blog, what is the effect of nanosilver on a young developing child? And we didn't know. I mean, science hadn't studied it. Science had studied some and had lots of experience with adults, but kids were different. And ultimately, the company decided to take Benny off the market, basically out of fear for potential lawsuits, because we didn't have science to completely adamantly claim that this was safe for children. It wasn't a government intervention. It was actually a company just fearing for its own stability who took it off the market.
So can you talk a little bit about the complexities of situations like that? I mean, to me, it sounds like I don't know what the quote-unquote right answer is there, right? Because, of course, yeah, you can say, oh, fear of lawsuits, that's, you know, it's so superficial. But on the other hand, you could take that one step back and say, well, fear of potential harm, that they're not, they don't understand the risks, you know, and so they decided to do that. But on the other hand, of course, you've just described there's all these kids that could benefit from this technology. So I feel like this is like a little microcosm of all the, you know, issues that we're talking
about.
Well, that's
why he's gotten 12 years of traction out of
it. Yeah,
that's a story. Benny the Bear travels with me to foreign countries things like that.
So, yeah. I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, what do we do with this information? What do we do with this story? Like, how do we proceed?
How do we proceed with this story? Well, I mean, the first thing is, there is no absolute right answer. One of the things we do, which is actually what we've been doing for 10 years now, is significantly increasing, at least for a while, the amount of funding we did to understand the environmental and human impact of nanoparticles.
And this is a big part of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, obviously.
I mean, there is a reason why that funding came. So, I mean, that's one of the responses, is everything we do in our life has some sort of risk. Mm-hmm. And we need to figure out methods to balance those risks. And I think this is a special situation. I think if this had been a coat for adults, nobody would have thought twice. And in fact, you can
buy shirts and stuff.
Yeah,
socks.
And nano silver socks. I mean, the big thing here was our desire to take on risks that we don't understand when it comes to children is incredibly low. That's an area that really raises a lot of red flags. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of thing we balance in innovation all the time. Almost every new innovation introduces new risks. But on balance, they may be less risky than old technologies. And that's something we constantly have to evaluate, both through science, scientific inquiry, but also with thinking about it socially and politically.
Remember, this was in, again, these early days of when we were thinking about nanotechnology. And we hadn't developed a robust regulatory structure around nanotechnology. Not that we have yet either. But you know, there's an interesting thing. What happens when you're operating outside of a regulatory structure that describes what you're working with is that tort law can then become the de facto regulator. So if you're operating with chemicals that have been studied and you're operating within the guidelines that have been given, you're not open to be subjected to as many lawsuits because you're following the rules, right? But if there's
rules that have actually been settled and discussed by PhDs with chemistry
and pushed through a bureaucratic process and become laws or regulations.
Yeah.
But if you're working in a space that, you know, I'm not saying these people were fast and loose, but they were working, you know, there wasn't yet a regulatory thing that dealt with materials based on size. And if you're a small company, you're not going to survive more than one of these lawsuits, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the piece of the story that Jamie didn't finish with, which is that they moved to a more conventional herbicide.
I don't think they ever did.
Oh.
But their proposal was to move to a more conventional
antibiotic system, which would have placed them back into a place where they were protected by regulation, right? So if they went to an FDA-approved antibiotic substance in this teddy bear, they would have been fine, right? Even if somebody had gotten sick.
They would have been fine legally.
Would have been
fine
legally.
It may have actually been more toxic than the nanosilver.
Sure, absolutely. But they would have been operating in a much more protected sort of liability place.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's where, you know, you have to start thinking about all of these pieces.
And, you know, if you're a small company and your product depends on a specific chemical that's not regulated, you are trusting your fate to a judge that you've never met before without a PhD in chemistry to decide whether or not what you did was right or wrong. Mm-hmm. And, you don't have nearly the protection. But because we are loath to regulate or legislate lately, a lot of those decisions are being made by judge, and thank God somebody's making those decisions because they do need to be made. But they're less predictable, and in business, anything that's less predictable is something you avoid.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I feel like we could probably talk for another hour. But is there kind of a take-home message as far as what do you hope people come away from a conversation with you, or whether it's students coming to one of your workshops or the general public coming to a museum? What's your aim there?
So, I mean, I'll talk 25 about...
25 words or less.
No. Oh, 25 words or less.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a PhD. It's going to take way more words than that. You can edit it down to 25 words.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, some of the things that I talked about today in this workshop that I want to try to get across to people is in this... I mean, we're in a very interesting political time right now. You know, any change of an administration involves lots of changes. We're changing into an administration that seems to be acting different than many of them in the past. this is a great time to go bone up on your civics 101, right? Because we're hearing about all of these things. There's executive actions, there's presidential budgets, there's congressional filibusters. We have a lot of stuff happening. And I would say to better understand what this the policies coming out right now have to do with science and how they're going to impact science, going back and learning a little bit about who has the power and the authority at various points in the scientific funding, in the agenda setting, knowing where those are will be very helpful in helping to sort of wade through the wall of information that's coming at us, right? So we have a scientific community that's trying to find maybe a new voice through this March for Science. Is that going to be scientists saying that they need more money and more authority? It seems almost like this presidential election was a pushback on that. Is there something else that scientists can do with that pulpit? So I think this interface between policy and science is something that we're now beginning to pay very much attention to because it appears to be under attack. But learning about the processes that are at play will help you figure out where the reality is.
And just one quick follow-up to what you just said, Ira. It doesn't always seem this way, I recognize, but Congress loves science. And Congress has loved science since at least World War II, and probably long before that. If you look at the federal funding for science, which is Congress's decision how much science funding we get, it has stayed pretty constant for a very long time. It does not matter who the president is.
Or what party has control of Congress.
Or what party has control of Congress. That's right, both sides of the aisle. Now, both sides of the aisle don't always love what comes out of science and some of the advice that scientists have for politicians. That's different. But funding stream, at least, has been pretty constant. So the one thing that I would like as a takeaway is the goal of my work largely is to debunk a myth. And the myth is that science and technology are happening and you just better deal with it. It's coming at you. You're either going to stand up and go with it, or you're going to duck it, or you're going to get run over. And the crazy thing is that I was used to hearing that from sort of random members of the public, but working with scientists and engineers, I realized how many of them believe that myth as well. And one of my goals is to say it's not true. It's not true. Science and technology are developed by actual, they're made by people, and they're a result of decisions made by a lot of different people. And we have the ability to have an impact and influence on that process.
We being the general public as well as
absolutely.
Academics and
No, the number of scientists I talk to that don't think they can actually have any say in the direction of science, I'm like, no, you can. But members of the public as well. Mm-hmm. And sometimes this is basically reduced to, well, I can decide which technologies to purchase or which ones I can't. But actually, there's many, many other ways that you can engage as well. At any given time, there are dozens of government dockets open waiting for public input into decision-making. Do you think gene drives are something that should be released across Florida over the next few years? You know, you can actually reflect on that idea, question it, think about it, learn a bit more about it, write a thoughtful letter to the federal government explaining how and why you believe this way, what you do. And ultimately, they have to respond to that. You won't get a personal letter back, but as they develop their policy, they must take into account all these different ideas.
Is there like a central repository for those, or you just have to kind of find them?
The Federal Register.
Okay, great. Yeah. We'll put a link in the show notes that people can check out. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
And that's it for this episode. Thanks again very much to Ira and Jamie for sitting down to talk with us when they were at the University of Minnesota. Thanks, as always, to the National Science Foundation, which funds the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology. Our usual disclaimer, of course, is that all opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the National Science Foundation. One little note about our discussion, we chatted in late March of 2017, and you heard mention of the concerns about the presidential budget that had been announced at that time, and of course since then we do have a budget that will continue through September of 2017, as of this point in May, and some of the fears about cuts to the National Institutes of Health in particular have been allayed at this point. So just a little update on that. If you want more Sustainable Nano, I hope you will follow us on social media. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Sustainable Nano, all one word. We'd love to hear from you. What do you like? What do you want to hear more of on the podcast? You can also find tons of blog posts that have been written by members of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology at our blog, sustainable-nano.com. And finally, I hope you will stay tuned for a few more episodes we've got coming up soon in the next month or so. For example, we've got an interview with author Valerie Young about the phenomenon of imposter syndrome and how that affects people in science. So thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.